Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Welcome to the FIC Focus podcast. This is a Macro Matters edition. My name is Ira Jersey. I'm the chief U.S. interest rate strategist for Bloomberg Intelligence, the research arm of Bloomberg LP. Joining me today in the BI headquarters in Princeton, New Jersey, is Will Hoffman, associate strategist at Bloomberg Intelligence. Will, you abandoned me last week. So, you know, what happened since the last time we recorded? And let's talk a little bit about, you know, your time away. So how was your week off? I didn't bug you. I didn't text you. I panicked once or twice. But, you know, we got through things.
Certainly did. It was supposed to be a quiet week, hence why I was freed for a few days. But it was certainly more interesting or exciting for you than it was for me, with a few rainy days in Mystic, Connecticut. We had markets closed on the Friday before when Powell spoke, and let's just say things were a little bit different on Monday morning than they were on Thursday evening or afternoon for those who got to celebrate an early close. But after ISM and some continued hotter than expected data, we saw a pretty material repricing across the curve last week. And that turns out we were just getting started. We saw a continuation of that this week with PPI a bit of a snoozer this morning, thankfully, after yesterday's excitement with, or lack thereof, depending on which way you were leaning. But with the beat on inflation, things moved pretty quickly. And now it's kind of a where to next and what are the next steps? And that's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, I guess we should start there with the CPI report from March, which came in better than expected and caused a pretty dramatic repricing of all things interest rates. Not a huge surprise, just given the lack of liquidity in some markets, the fact that there were a number of investors that we were talking to who were leaning long, you still had, as of that report, a lot of consensus economic forecasters still saying that the Federal Reserve is going to cut interest rates and maybe cut pretty aggressively. But as you get reports like this, it just becomes less and less likely. So it wasn't unreasonable, the price action that you saw in the rates market. Importantly, and I think that this is something that, those people who aren't intimately familiar with the way that rates markets work, they're surprised that you haven't seen more bear steepening of the yield curve, right? This idea that the yield curve is still inverted, twos, tens inverted by 20 basis points. A lot of the curve, quite frankly, is very flat. Look at fives and sevens, even threes, fives and sevens, and basically they're all flat. But when you have twos, tens inverted by 40 basis points, all that's really suggesting is that the market continues to think that at some point the Federal Reserve's next moves are going to be to lower interest rates. Doesn't necessarily say exactly when, doesn't necessarily say exactly to the magnitude, but that effectively at some point that the curve's going to invert. And you still have, you know, 2-year yields as we're recording today at around 5%. And 5% does suggest that within the next 2 years that the Federal Reserve will cut interest rates probably at least twice. There's a lot of different ways you can get there. You can cut, you know, they can not cut for a while and then suddenly cut 100 basis points kind of, you know, 9 months or a year from now. And that would still get us to that average of 50 basis points of rate cuts. But nonetheless, the market is still pricing that way, but much less than it was. And I think that's, you know, ultimately that the question is not so much, you know, why have we sold off? Are we near fair value? The answer is yes, we're pretty close to fair value given all the economic data that we have. But what is the next likely move? And that's where I think some of the recent, you know, moves in some markets can be pretty telling.
Absolutely. I mean, the big focus, especially in headlines, has been about when is the cutting cycle going to begin? Everybody's hyper-focused on, will it be March? Will it be May? Well, no, it's not going to be March. May seems unlikely. June has now gone from 50-50 to far less. And now July and September are looking like the start point. But a far less frequently discussed topic is the extent of rate cuts over the medium and long term, not just kind of the focus on short term starting times. And something that I think is worth noting is, as you mentioned, 50 basis points priced in approximately to twos. We're just seeing a little over 50 basis points priced into Fed meeting date OIS for the next 8 meetings or 1 year. And that's a pretty material deviation from what we had seen, well, frankly, just before my vacation. And so I guess with the inflation print, particularly Supercore, something that we remarked on pretty early, was the acceleration there on a three-month annualized basis from a little over 6% to a little over 8%, which I think I can go out on a limb and call that a non-trivial increase. And given the ties that Supercore has to strengthen the labor market, particularly as it relates to wage growth, there may be challenges in getting that number down in the near and medium term. And I think yesterday's market reaction really reflects that.
And this is something that we talked about in a piece that we're putting out as you're reading this or listening to this. You can read our note, but we note that lower volatility sectors, so those are services sectors, generally speaking, what Will was just talking about, tend to be stickier and tend not to move as quickly. And those are still seeing 4% year-on-year growth in those core services sectors that continue to be one of the big drivers of inflation. Another big reason why you had the miss of inflation to the upside was that you saw energy-related sectors within the core CPI, because even though energy is excluded directly from core, there's other sectors such as transportation that are still affected pretty significantly by fuel prices. And you saw actually a positive contribution from those sectors on a year-on-year basis for only the second time in the last year. So you have basically a variety of factors that are kind of conspiring to potentially keep inflation at levels that are unacceptable to the Fed for the next 2, 3, 4 months. And then you get to the point where if the Federal Reserve doesn't make a move, doesn't cut in July, then I suspect that they'll wait until November. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of talk, and you're going to hear more and more talk about, will the Federal Reserve cut and make a move in September just before an election? Will they be political? Won't they be political? They say that they're not going to be political, but, you know, there's only been one instance where within 2 months of an election that they've actually made a first move. They've continued moves, right? So if they start cutting in July, there's no reason why they can't cut again in September, because they've already basically popped the cork on the moves, so they can continue to kind of pour out some of the liquidity that they think that the market needs. But they won't start, I don't think, in September. They would just wait till November. You know, 6 weeks in the grand scheme of things, in their view, is not that big of a deal. So unless there's some kind of liquidity crisis or exogenous shock where the financial sector or the banking sector or consumers are really need a rate cut, I think that they'll avoid September if they can. So we should probably move on to the next topic, just because we spent a bit of time on that, and that would be the minutes. So was there one thing that you really concentrated on, Will? And I'm leading you here because I know that you did from the minutes that you know you think probably didn't get as much attention as it deserves, but is probably the most important thing that we got in the minutes yesterday.
Absolutely, and I do think it's worth noting that a lot of the information that we received in these minutes is not as relevant as it was during the meeting, given how much data has changed since then.
So some of us call that OBE, or overcome by events. So the minutes were from 3 weeks ago. So a lot of the economic news and the economic data, and even some of the views of the Fed members, probably were somewhat less relevant after the payrolls report and the CPI report.
Absolutely. I mean, you've even got Kashkari coming out this morning saying, bringing up phrases like indefinite pauses and things like that, which I would say probably were not going to be contained in the transcript when we do eventually get that from this meeting. But I do think the most important part of these meeting minutes is something that I, as a balance sheet nerd, and you who taught me all that I know about being a balance sheet nerd, really was looking for and raced to find, was commentary on the evolution about talking about thinking about balance sheet runoff. And that seems to be, after reading the minutes, a taper seems to be in the cards for the next few meetings. And they made it very clear that they're trying to decouple rate policy and balance sheet policy, as one is very different than the other insofar as what it can break instantaneously. They expressed concern over estimates and the standard error of those estimates around the LCLOR, or lowest comfortable level of reserves, which is what we hit in 2020 or 2019, which led to the repo market hiccup and subsequent changes in policy. They've expressed a view that they are very, very remiss to do that again. And so rather than kind of speed down 95, knowing there's a brick wall at some point along those few hundred miles, but not knowing exactly where it is, it is wise from a risk management perspective to begin to taper the pace of runoff so that they can glide their way towards the LCLOR without materially disrupting kind of repo markets and funding markets, much like what happened in 2019. And by reducing and balance sheet runoff on the treasury side from, let's say, like they said, about half, which is a little bit broader than some would have liked, but call it $60 billion to $30 billion, that will allow them to not only calculate and, I guess, triangulate where LCLOR is as they get closer, and they can monitor pressures and funding markets as they arise. But they do believe, or seem to believe, that this will allow them to reduce their balance sheet size the most by allowing QT to continue for as long as it can. And also, very importantly, they noted they would like to run off MBS for as long as possible. And that's something we had been expecting, particularly after comments on maybe reshuffling the composition of the Fed's portfolio towards a higher tilt of bills, and especially with their express view of returning to a treasury-only portfolio. We think that's a very, very possible likelihood. So announce in May or June, and or sorry, announce in June and enact in July seems to be our call and our base case.
Yeah, I think that that's possible. It's possible that they announce in May to start in June. That wouldn't completely surprise me either. So, you know, the issue with the idea that they can reduce quantitative tightening, that the pace of quantitative tightening, and that will mean that they could actually get their balances, their securities balances down even further. I disagree with that. I just don't think that that's likely. You're going to get to the same level. It's just going to take you longer. The good thing about what they're doing with this taper is that it lets them ease into it a bit. So there's no reason why at some point in the future, where let's say that at quarter end, if like at the year end, we wind up seeing the Fed's standing repo facility get tapped for $50 billion or something like that, but otherwise it's not tapped at all, then they know they're getting close to that lowest comfortable level of reserves. So then at the January meeting, maybe they cut it even more, right? So maybe they take Treasury QE and they either get rid of it or just, you know, cut it to $10 billion a month or something like that. And so they have limited QT then at that point. And at some point they just go cold turkey, or they just let mortgages run off and that's the only thing. But at some point, you are going to reach that level. And it's probably sometime in 2025 that we reach that lowest comfortable level of reserves. I call it the tipping point. You wind up having usage of the standing repo facility, although there is some doubt that people will use it because apparently there's some stigma. I'm not sure that I understand exactly why there's stigma, but there is this idea that there's stigma. So you could see a day not completely dissimilar to 2019, where you have SOFR, you know, spike 200 basis points or so, and then the Federal Reserve has to come in and actually do regular traditional open market operations and repo operations to inject liquidity. And then once that occurs, they would then have to go cold turkey and basically stop runoff altogether. I think that they continue to run off the mortgage portfolio and reinvest those mortgages into treasuries. Over time, and this is the piece of information that we don't have yet, is what is going to be and what is their thoughts on the ultimate composition of the balance sheet. And this is something we'll be looking for in the May minutes. So will they, once they have more assets to reinvest, will they buy more T-bills and somewhat less coupons to try to make their portfolio more in line with the treasury markets that's currently outstanding? That would mean getting T-bills up to about 20% of their portfolio, which will take quite a long time to do at the current runoff pace, but nonetheless, it'll probably happen. So then the last thing in our last 3 or 4 minutes here is talking about some upcoming events that investors need to be aware of, and that would be the Treasury refunding announcement, which will take place in a couple of weeks at the beginning of May for the May refunding. We don't expect there to be any additional increases in coupon sizes, but there could be another announcement, Will, that we'll get some headlines And, you know, we could talk about how meaningful they it may or may not be for markets.
Absolutely. And there was a piece of paper that circulated while I was away, the instance of the first of the Treasury's liquidity support buyback operations, distinct from their cash management operations, which will be a slightly different topic with a bit more flexibility. But the Treasury is going to be buying back off the run securities, very likely to begin, if not at the May refunding, the following. At some point in 2024 is almost guaranteed. And I think it's very important to point out what Treasury buybacks are and what they are not. This is not a form of stealth quantitative easing, nor is it akin to a taper or twist operation that was done by the Fed in the past. And it is, well, it's not QE in the sense that reserves are temporarily instantaneously created, but then drained back over the course of weeks via increased auction sizes. The buybacks do not increase the monetary base, nor do they increase the amount of public debt outstanding. It is simply essentially a coupon switch of, or a switch from a deep off the run with a similar maturity on the run. This is meant to improve liquidity given very constrained dealer balance sheets, which is something we've remarked over the last few years, and is not, again, meant to change or shift the portfolio composition of the Treasury's outstanding debt. It's limited to $30 billion across the curve per quarter, which is rather small in the grand scheme of a $25-plus trillion market.
And that was, quite frankly, what surprised me the most was that it wasn't, you know, probably $50 to $60 billion is what I was expecting. So the fact that it's only basically $10 billion a month is, you know, probably limits the efficacy of the program. That being said, and I think the important thing about this, Will, and I'm sorry I cut you off is that the reason why this kind of buyback program enhances liquidity is because there are assets and that wind up getting stuck on dealer balance sheets. So when you think about how the market functions, when dealers try to take down some bonds, if they buy some off-the-run securities, oftentimes it's difficult for them to sell it. It's not difficult for them to hedge it, and you know they do get a little bit cheap sometimes within the curve, so you can look at some fair value relative value models and determine that these bonds are particularly cheap. But investors still don't necessarily want to purchase them because they want to own more liquid securities like on the run securities. So what the primary benefit of having this program is that it takes those treasuries off the dealer balance sheets, effectively replaces them with more on the run securities, and basically increases and enhances liquidity of the entire market. You know, it'd be interesting to see if how it works. Like I suspect that if they do target a couple of sectors where dealer balance sheets have more off-the-run securities on them, they might be able to actually get some sectors a little bit more unstuck. So it will be a good test, and it doesn't preclude the Treasury Department from increasing the size in the future either, right? So I think maybe they're easing into it in a way, and certainly trying to manage their portfolio in such a way where they're not really taking out a lot of market risk, but still helping market function, right? Then, yeah, you know, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to say, well, let markets be markets, blah, blah, blah. There's too much debt outstanding. I'm sure there's a lot of people who are saying that, and we're not in that camp either. But it's certainly, I think that it's going to be an interesting test to see just how much dealers benefit and the market benefits liquidity-wise from this program.
Absolutely. And not to take a pun off of our podcast title of Macro Matters, but the mechanics really matter here. And I think that's the most important piece.
Yeah, market structure matters. And with that, we're at time. I am Ira Jersey, the chief rate strategist for BI. With me is Will Hoffman, an associate strategist in the rates team here at Bloomberg Intelligence. If you have any ideas for guests that you'd like to hear on the show, or you have any topics you want us to hit on, please hit us up on the Bloomberg Terminal. And until next time, be well.